your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We appreciate your courtesy, and we hope that the young man does well. So we will proceed with Attorney John Pollack.
May it please the Court, I'm here today on behalf of the National Coalition for Civil Right to Counsel, and we wanted to thank you for this opportunity to testify in person as well as the opportunity we had to submit written comments to the Court earlier. The National Coalition is an informal association of more than 220 individuals in 35 states, and our mission is to ensure meaningful access to the courts, much like is the purpose of this petition. We are a very state and locally driven effort, responsive to what each jurisdiction determines is necessary for it, just as we feel that this petition, being driven locally by advocates in the community here, is that kind of effort. We focus on the five basic human needs areas that you've heard mentioned earlier, shelter, safety, sustenance, health, and child support. Those areas are slightly different but very similar to the ones that are highlighted in the petition. My goal here today was to just mention two things. One is to talk a little bit about the support we've seen from the judiciary at the highest levels for expanding access to civil counsel, and the other is to elaborate upon the discretionary appointment statutes that I mentioned in our written comments. We work a lot with advocates across the country, and what we've seen from the judiciaries at the highest level, again, is a real recognition of the need to expand access to civil counsel and also taking steps to actually do that as well. In California, you've heard about the pilots today. Chief Justice Ronald George was a very vocal advocate of the pilots and actually met specifically with the governor to ensure that the governor supported the pilots. And in supporting them, he talked about the vast number of unrepresented litigants in California and how that negatively impacted the efficiency of the courts. And he said that the funding proposed, which was $11 million per year, was, quote, a small cost for an initiative of such importance both to the court system and to individuals seeking justice. In New York, Chief Justice Jonathan Lippman has been incredibly active on the civil access to justice front. He put $15 million into the court's budget to provide for access to civil justice. And in talking about Gideon v. Wainwright and how it recognized the need for counsel to have a fair hearing, he said, nearly a half a century after Gideon, is it not an equally obvious truth that there are certain types of civil proceedings involving fundamental human needs where it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, for a person to get his or her day in court to obtain due process without a lawyer's help?
Well, the chief judge is holding hearings around the state of New York, and I don't know if they're on their second or third or maybe even fourth by now. What does the chief judge intend to accomplish by this? Does he want more money from the legislature?
Yes, Chief Justice, he's actually doing this in part to support his request for expanded legal aid funding. He's also talked about, I was going to mention that when he's talked about his plans for New York, he said, I'm not talking about a single initiative, pilot project, or temporary program, but what I believe must be a comprehensive, multifaceted, systemic approach to providing counsel. And that's something, looking at the issue systemically and providing the power to appoint counsel across the board, is similar to what we see in this petition and is a main reason why we're supportive of it. I'd also note that he said he recognized that the state was in what he called terrible fiscal shape. But he added to that, access to justice can never be sacrificed. It is not a luxury, affordable only in good times, or something that should fluctuate according to the ups and downs of the economy. So there was a real recognition there that even though New York was in terrible shape, it was necessary for him to press ahead with this plan. And we've seen that, again, that the same support from the Maine Supreme Judicial Court and from New Hampshire Supreme Judicial Court as well. The other thing I'll mention quickly is that there are eight states that statutorily provided for their trial courts to be able to appoint counsel. The issue with those and the thing that the petition does that corrects that problem is those statutes lack the guidance to the trial courts as to how they're supposed to decide when to appoint. And also, they don't provide the funding necessary to make those appointments possible. And in the absence of both of those provisions, what's happened on the ground that we've been told is that the judges are very reluctant to exercise this authority, even though it's there. And they need that guidance, and they need the clarification on the funding that they have. In four of those states, there's literally no factors at all, neither from the courts nor in the statute. And consequently, the statutes are very underutilized in those states, and that's something that we're working to correct. I also mentioned in the comments that eight states have gone so far as to have their state courts create rules for appointment of counsel, even when there wasn't a statute that similarly provided for appointment of counsel in that area. Often the court rules are parallel to statutes, but in these cases, they actually went beyond any statutory authority, and the courts themselves said, we determined that these areas are important enough that we need to provide for appointment of counsel. I'd just like to conclude by saying we think this petition is a very wise approach to appointment of counsel by providing the broad discretion and by allowing the judges to determine which case it is in which they need to appoint counsel because they're the ones who have the case in front of them, whether it be housing, family law, or domestic violence or anything, and be able to make that decision by providing that authority. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pollack. Attorney John Skilton, past president, State Bar of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is John Skilton. I represent no one other than myself, but will say I've been practicing law in this state since 69. That's 1960.
I remember you.
I think that's a good thing. In my work in New York a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to pick up the New York Times, and I refer the court to an editorial dated Wednesday, August 24, 2011. I only wish to read two sentences from it, but it struck me hard when I read them. In civil proceedings like divorces, child support cases, home foreclosures, bankruptcies, and landlord-tenant disputes, the number of people representing themselves in court has soared since the economy has soured. Experts estimate that four-fifths of low-income people have no access to a lawyer when they need one. The operative portion of that sentence or the last four words. I have had the opportunity to testify about issues like this to Ethics 2000, to other august groups, but never before have I had the chance to talk to a committee that has the constitutional authority to do something about it. And I thank the court for taking the time and having the commitment to hear testimony on this problem that seems so intractable. 15 years ago, I chaired a commission that issued a report which made many of the suggestions that ultimately were implemented, many by this court at its own time and with a lot of effort by the justices. In fact, I think I was certainly could be properly described as a Band-Aid man, as the court described earlier. And when you read articles like the New York Times editorial, you say to yourself, not much has been done. Have we failed, and did I in my very small efforts in the context of these issues fail? And it's a sobering thought, really, to think of it in those terms, but my response is that we fail only when we quit. This is a problem that relates to the quality of the delivery of justice to the citizens of this state as well as this country. I've always conceptualized the problem, which was real and apparent, during my tenure and certainly earlier as a three-legged stool issue. And certainly one leg of that stool is the bar and the lawyers in the bar. And that relates to matters of pro bono delivery, which we all have the obligation to do, and getting our pocketbooks out, spending our money on things that count, supporting the system and the court in its efforts. And another one of those legs was the legislature, because I've always believed, and I think most lawyers do believe, that this is a public responsibility. It is not strictly the lawyers or even the courts to solve alone. But the third leg of my stool has always been this court, because it holds the bully pulpit. It holds the power of the bar. It holds the ability to persuade, to organize the lawyers, to make the decisions that are hard. And by definition, my stool has the conflict between the legislature and the court built into it. It's inevitable, with the pushing and shoving that goes with that inevitably. With the legislature saying, we have our priorities, we can't afford it. But the court having to stand up and say, but this is something you cannot afford not to do. You must do it on those issues which this court deems are worthy of its attention. That is what separation of powers means. That is what it means to have an independent judiciary. That is why we fight for our system as lawyers and judges. This is the kind of issue that surfaces that very tension. My belief is that the petition should be granted, but I also thank the court for its attention to the issue, because if it's not this exact solution, it's got to be something. We can't quit on this problem. We can't just ignore it. It won't just go away. It's getting worse. So it's up to us. And when I say us, I mean the bar as well. I mean the bar taking hold of this, supporting the court, being a part of the solution in every respect in order that this problem not persist, or at least that it gets better. I thank the court for, I think, recognizing that issue and holding this hearing and for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Skilton.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Justice Prosser.
We had the pleasure of your testimony on November 9th, 2010, on a different issue, but somewhat parallel issue. The court didn't take you up on that issue.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The court did not take you up on that issue.
Did not, although it did issue an opinion.
What was the issue? Just so we were all in the know and remember the issue and...
This was the public defender rate issue.
Got it. I
suppose it would be very cheesy and unfair to say, if you had one or the other, which would you take? So I'm not going to ask that. Why...
I was a lawyer for that first group, so it's really, I couldn't answer anyway.
Why should the result today be different from the result after your first hearing, that other hearing?
Well, you more or less asked me to say, was the result right in the first hearing? I did invite and I do agree with the expressions that the court gave in that decision. I do believe very much that the court took a grasp of the shared responsibility aspect. It did recognize, I think, the fiscal reality of the situation. And so my answer to this question is to say that that is a half a loaf, needless to say. I do not invite constitutional confrontation, but I do think that there are issues upon which this court can speak. And, for example, the way, as I understand this petition, has been designed, it affords the discretion to the trial judge under prescribed conditions and for the right reasons and for the right persons to afford counsel. And, yes, there is an element of figure out how you pay for it. But that's the only way this court can function, I think, within its constitutional prerogatives, and that is to guarantee to the individual who is in that courtroom over which you have control, fairness. That is what you do have control over. The issue of financing, you know better than I, is a lot of jawboning with the other branches of government. But what isn't subject to debate, I believe, is the constitutional issue of proper representation in the right case. It's not subject to debate. That's the court's responsibility.
Well, in the Jody case, that the court didn't describe that as a constitutional right. So I think we have to distinguish between what is good public policy and what is a constitutional imperative. And I don't hear you saying here that, or I don't hear the witnesses saying that we're talking about constitutional right in every case here.
I'm certainly not saying that. That is not the premise of the petition. But I do think that the Chief was getting close to a constitutional issue when you convert that to due process issues. If you ask me what my personal opinion is, that I think there are due process implications that are founded in the Wisconsin Constitution as well as in the United States Constitution to this issue. But that is not the way this petition is being presented to the court. And my view, again, is in any event, this court has the inherent power to order fairness in its courts. Whether it's viewed as constitutional or good public policy, you are the controller of fairness in your trial courts.
I'm looking out at this audience, and frankly, I do not see any members of the news media here. I could be wrong. When this court has little controversies, the place is packed with news media. Why aren't they here today?
Well, they should be, shouldn't they?
Whose fault is that?
Maybe mine, and maybe every person who's in this room shares that blame. It's to the same extent that people who are poor and without lawyers don't have very good representation anywhere. Can I say they're ignored? If they're not ignored, at least they're not viewed as powerful. And this society, because of the way power is divided, tends to favor people who have loud voices and big pocketbooks. That's the way it is.
Was there an effort to get the news media here?
That I cannot tell you, Justice. I think Wisconsin Eye is here.
And you should correct the record. If I'm not mistaken, Wisconsin Public Radio was here this morning. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you care,
well,
it's out.
If I may, Chief Justice, I'm looking out at the audience now, and I don't see any news media.
Right.
And the representative of Wisconsin Public Radio left before the justice from California and the former president of the American Bar Association and Mr. Skilton. Yes.
Your Honor, may I see the podium?
Just 1 second. And the point of all this is about media? Ms. Abbott.
We made significant effort to inform the media about this issue and about this hearing. And right now, there's a significant article on JS Online. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has been watching Wisconsin Eye, watching the hearing on Wisconsin Eye. So we did the best we can. You know, we wish we were the Packers, the Brewers, or the Badgers.
But, don't we all? Yeah. At half court in Lambeau Field.
That's a good idea. So we made a significant effort, and we get the response that we get, well, and we've gotten some.
You make a good point. there may be whoever is in the courtroom is one thing, but this is streamed audio across the state on the internet. And Wisconsin, I don't know what their coverage is. That is, whether it's live now or they're going to broadcast it later, but it is visible. So here we are, with or without media. Mr. Skilton.
I'm sorry, you had a question?
No, I'm asking whether you're done.
I'm done.
Chief, I have a question.
Some might say I'm cooked.
Hey, no, you're not done. Justice Bradley has a question.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Jody B. case or not, but that's the case that was referred to earlier by some of the Milwaukee County Circuit Court judges also. And there's a discussion in the Jody B. case about due process. And I remember, I think it was towards the end someplace, a line hit me. I think it was in that case that, you know, due process means a trial that is fair, and that's what we're here talking about. But I want to focus in on the petition. Perhaps you're able to assist me, maybe not. But the language in Jody B. indicates that it's not a categorical right under due process. We recognize, and this dealt with a specific statute, the legislature has a legitimate interest in its efforts to manage the public funds responsibly. However, we conclude that in some cases, the state's pecuniary interest will not outweigh the interest shared by the state and the parent in a just and accurate result. And so it indicates that in some cases, we conclude that fundamental fairness requires a circuit judge be given the discretion to make the determination of what due process requires on a case-by-case basis, cites Lassiter, cites our case of Piper. Nevertheless, we, as well as the United States Supreme Court, have concluded that due process requires an individual determination of the necessity of appointment under the circumstances presented by the particular case. So I'm just reading right out of Jody B. I see this petition as more categorical as opposed to each individual case. Is there a way to provide better standards to assist in an individual case rather than categorical? Now, the categories are limited here. I think I counted 8 categories in the petition. It's kind of food, shelter, clothing, health, you know, and 4 others. But if that's what the constitutional provision is, if that's what it means on a case-by-case basis, how do we take that case-by-case and give it some further clarification and definition so that it can be meaningful other than the normal, you take the rights of the litigant, the rights of the state, you've got a presumption of, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Since I didn't draft the petition and I'm not in any official capacity for the petitioners, I hate to be too flippant about this. Mm-hmm. I defer to those who have thought about it harder. My sense of what was being said to the court, however, this morning is that they were more in line with Joni B. as you just read the case, that it was viewed to be a case-by-case issue. And the reason to have this rule is that, in fact, it wasn't being treated that way by all courts in this state, that it was either education or funds or whatever. They were reluctant to or unaware that they could operate on a case-by-case basis. And so the rule has a function, even if it's to affirm the rule of Joni B. on a broader scale. Joni B., I think, is, you know, when I'm arguing a case, I wouldn't dare say this, but I haven't read the case yet. But just as you describe it, it's limited to a particular circumstance. But that principle is broader, needless to say, as you read it, and it seems to me that that is the principle that the court can and should embed in a rule that is then circulated to the public as well as to the judges and lawyers in the state so that they know that is an available right in the proper circumstance for the proper person.
It raises a drafting problem, which I'll set out because we've got a lot of other speakers and they may be able to address it. Drafting problem is, as I see it, read it, and hear it, that it says the court shall provide counsel, but then in the second sentence it says may, and it's discretionary. And that fits both the inherent power that is in the court to provide counsel, so that is an is, not an ought, an is. Whether it does in any proceeding is discretionary, balancing the factors that are set forth in two parts of the Joni case. One part is the inherent power for fairness, which has a set of factors. And the second part is due process fairness, which has a different set of factors, both in the same case, at least as I read the case. So it seems to me that's one of the issues, that to make clear that the power is there, but it is exercised in discretion for a fairness standard, whether it be the first fairness or the second.
Well, if I may be a little presumptuous, I would say that probably the best wordsmithers in the state are sitting in front of me.
You're passing the buck, sir. But we accept the buck, okay? Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a couple of lists of speakers, and I'm going to go down it, and if I err and I'm not calling the right people or ignore someone, it's unintentional, and you should call it to my attention. So I have Christopher Hanovich, President, Wisconsin Equal Justice Fund.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. I am current sitting president for the Wisconsin Equal Justice Fund. As this Court, at least some of its members may know, WEJF is a nonprofit fundraising organization that distributes private contributions from Wisconsin attorneys and law firms through the Wisconsin Trust Account Foundation to three legal services providers: Legal Action of Wisconsin, the petitioner in this case, Disability Rights Wisconsin, and Wisconsin Judicare. I have three very brief points to raise. I will not repeat the, I think, very eloquent and important points raised by my prior speakers. First off, this is not the first time we as a state have wrestled with how to deal with the so-called justice gap. As the Chief Justice remarked, this court, the state bar, and individual attorneys have for years recognized and tried to ameliorate the situation with many commendable efforts. Second, WEJF was one of those efforts. I believe it was Justice Rogensack who asked earlier, where can we find the money? The question of funding has come up repeatedly today. WEJF is one of the places that this state has looked to try to find the money to provide a solution to this justice gap. It's a permanent, professional organization with a very targeted purpose to funnel monies toward legal services groups providing aid to Wisconsin's poor. And over the course of its existence, it's raised nearly $4 million in contributions for those organizations, which I think illustrates that Wisconsin attorneys, in addition to their extensive pro bono work, will put their money where their mouth is. The problem with this is it's just not nearly enough. While I certainly have no desire to diminish or minimize the efforts of the Wisconsin Equal Justice Fund or any of the other Band-Aids that the Chief Justice referenced, I am nonetheless cognizant that we are, in fact, a Band-Aid, and a Band-Aid that has thus far not, at least by itself or in conjunction with the other commendable efforts, been enough. As one of the people who was out there knocking on the doors, both of my own firm and of attorneys around the state, I can tell you that I am continuously impressed with how much people are willing to give, but I am nonetheless continuously daunted at how much more is required.
Counselor, in your work of raising money, have you contacted any private nonprofit foundations throughout the United States trying to get money for this kind of a program?
We have not, Your Honor, and I will defer to those who have been. Mr. Skilton, for example, has been a part of the group much longer than I. It is my understanding that our mandate is very targeted, that the groups themselves, for example, Legal Action, we will work with to help facilitate access, but the monies flow directly to them and not to us, which I think probably makes more sense from an administrative perspective. So we would not be the entity to seek that out. We would go to individual contributors.
I see. All right.
You throw the Eisenberg dinner?
We do indeed, Chief Justice, and let me extend an invitation to all of the justices to attend. This is the first year it's been in Madison for quite some time. That is our chief fundraising activity. Lastly, this is simply too important an issue to leave to the whim of individual contributions, even when they are as generous as they have been here. Private contributions will fail and will reduce when economic times are at their worst. We need real systemic protections that are not subject to the whim of the stock market or of ever-changing political platforms. Our future as a democracy will be tied in great part to our ability to deliver on the promise of equal access to justice for all. The credibility of our civil justice system is eroding, and it will continue to erode as long as our poorest citizens are effectively victims of, as opposed to participants in, that system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanovich.
Yes, Justice Prosser.
You indicated that your major effort at fundraising was the dinner.
That's correct.
Do you make an appeal at the same time as the bar dues, too, or not?
We do. We have recently begun advertising as part of that, Your Honor. We appeal to people throughout the year. We find as we get closer toward the dinner is when we get responses, but we have sought and received contributions throughout the year during various events, and we are now becoming more aggressive. And I need to do more. We need to do more as an organization. It's my hope we can double or maybe triple the roughly $350,000 a year we get. As I mentioned, it's still not enough, but it's an important part of the Band-Aids.
But just to be specific, is this something that members can check off on the bar?
No.
It is not.
Oh, it's not.
It is not.
And has that been considered?
It is not in my tenure as president, Justice Prosser. It would be my expectation that that may lead to some issues, given the bar's rather heated internal controversies at times about charitable giving and things to, again, I would defer to my good friend and mentor, Mr. Skilton. We have thus far tried to maintain a somewhat lower profile with more direct contact through friends and colleagues. We have a substantial board and have avoided that more aggressive approach.
There's, and I'm trying hard to remember, but this issue of what would be added to the bar dues as an optional has come up before, and the list could become quite lengthy. And I think that for that reason, bar doesn't do that. And then, if I remember other bar dues that I pay, they add it in and then they show that as a final amount. And then lawyers and their staff tend to just pay the whole thing and then they get angry that they really didn't have to pay at all, but no one read it carefully enough. So this was an issue many a year ago, and the result was no one was on it. And that I guess if one group starts to get on, there'll be others that would like to do that. But my recollection is still a little hazy, so you might talk to Mr. Skilton and see if his recollection is any better.
Thank you, Chief
on
Justice.
That issue. But it has been a recurring issue. Thank you. And I'm sorry, anything else? Justice Prosser.
Does the money in your fund go to organizations like Legal Action of Wisconsin or Judicare, or does it go somewhere else?
It goes to three organizations, Your Honor, Legal Action of Wisconsin, Disability Rights Wisconsin, and Wisconsin Judicare, and it's through the Wisconsin Trust Account Foundation.
Okay.
Justice Crooks reminds me that, and he is on the board, the Law Foundation is shown on the bar dues.
It's shown as a separate category that you can or cannot give to, but it is shown on the bar dues.
They don't
dues
add
form.
It in.
No.
The Law Foundation is.
Yeah, correct. But they don't add it in so that people would automatically pay mm-hmm. that larger sum. Maybe yeah. that's where the fight came in. Yeah, but there was something.
On the ABA dues form, they do have
Equal
Justice Fund that's yeah. added in.
Right.
And you can take it off if you want, but it's there.
And that was tried, and there was an objection to that. And maybe that's the exact example I'm thinking of, but I can't remember. Thank you. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you.
Attorney Winston Ostrow. From Green Bay. Everybody happy in Green Bay?
Everybody's very happy in Green Bay.
Hot. Good. Just checking.
I've practiced as a private practitioner in Green Bay for the last 36 years. The last 22 of those years I've been with Godfrey and Kahn. Excuse me. But I'm here today speaking just for myself, not for the firm, obviously. I do appreciate the fact that the court's taken up this petition, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak. Avoiding repetition, I'd like to address something that hasn't been discussed, really. I think there's been a little bit of an insinuation that somebody benefits from the current dysfunctional system. As a matter of fact, that's not true. I can tell the court, and you probably know this already, that all litigators and all commercial clients of litigators absolutely hate to get involved in pro se litigation. There's a little bit of an implication that we're getting away with something, but the fact is when people have everything at stake, desperate people do desperate things, and you're dealing with people who are dealing with a system that speaks a language they don't understand, and they don't have an interpreter. We don't give them an interpreter. And many times it ends up with a judge trying to be the interpreter, and the courts are burdened, or it ends up with the lawyer for the commercial party taking the grave ethical risk of trying to interpret the system to these people. And what we really have is a system that's serving nobody the way it is. I think there's also a little bit of a suggestion here that appointing counsel means you're going to appoint Clarence Darrow and every case is going to turn into a big deal. I think just the opposite is true. Most of the time, if people have counsel, they arrive at reasonable accommodations because they understand what's going on. To go back to my metaphor, they have an interpreter. They understand the system. They see what the possibilities are. They understand what the risks are, and they're able to handle things in a rational way. Right now, we're denying a lot of people those opportunities in very important situations, and it's really not benefiting anyone. As far as the money situation is concerned, we mentioned Green Bay, and one of the things we're proud of in Green Bay is this summer we spent about $1 million on a roller coaster, which the city built in our amusement park. It's wonderful. Somehow we found that money. About 30 years ago, the Honorable Charles Keene in Green Bay, the Brown County Circuit Court, appointed me as counsel for a pro se party. And I did that, and I submitted my bill to the county, and somehow Brown County found the wherewithal to pay that bill. Unless this court does something, however, nobody is going to recognize this problem. There's nobody else in our society that's going to recognize the problem and say, this is important, this is something we need to raise money for. And so I really would support the petition and ask this court to send that message. Because it's a very important message, and if we aren't going to take care of the justice system and it's not going to be a justice system, then we might as well all pack our bags and go home.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank
you. Any questions? Thank you. Attorney E. Michael McCann, Milwaukee County District Attorney, retired.
If it please the court, my name is E. Michael McCann. I appear in support of the petition. I am representing myself and not anyone else. Because this is such a young court, I thought I would draw on experience that might be useful. Many of you were not practicing law between 63 and 67 when I started. At that time, until 1967, I think it was the Argersinger case, came in and required the appointment, if necessary, to represent a misdemeanor if that person faced a significant possibility of incarceration. So for 4 years I practiced before then, from 63 to 67, when the courts were trying to be fair to these people, they were appearing without counsel for the most part. And I think I'll tell you of a case that epitomizes the injustices that could occur. It was a busy morning. It was a misdemeanor court. I was not there as the trial assistant, but I was there as an assistant DA on other business. There was a quick trial proceeded, and the judge sentenced the man to 90 days. The bailiff stepped up and started to lead him out of the courtroom, and then the man turned. And it was not satirically, it wasn't sarcastically, and he said to the judge, "When do I get my jury trial?" He'd been tried already and convicted and sentenced. And this just seemed to encapsulate problems when people appear without counsel. And it was where conscientious efforts were made. Sometimes during the trial of such a case, without counsel present, a fact would pop up that was unknown to the prosecution, that was absolutely key to innocence, and once that fact was presented by the defendant, the case was in effect over. And that would have been, there would have been no case if a counsel had appeared or at an earlier stage and said, "Look, at Mr. District Attorney, do you know about this case, this fact?" And I can recall as an assistant DA in those years, I sometimes just quit invoking the hearsay rule because it was an engine of injustice. Because people who had a good defense would bring it in by hearsay instead of presenting the person. And I just felt it was up to the judge to give such weight as he or she thought the rule ought to get, because I felt invoking it was defeating justice when people were unrepresented and didn't know that if I bring this person in, I can win this case. Private counsel can't do that. In private litigation, under a constraint to act as zealously as you possibly can for your client, even though a lawyer might feel a private lawyer, my case would be defeated if that evidence got in. He can't or she can't waive the hearsay rule because he or she must zealously represent his client. So there must be cases where people are appearing in courts all the time, where private counsel objects, but who surely knows, because those cases were so frequent, that if I let that evidence come in, or if there were a person presented to testify instead of hearsay, I couldn't win the case. So without counsel, critically, and those criminal cases, there was so much at stake, and judges were trying to be fair, and there were miscarriages of justice. So it crossed the range of private cases that has to continue. When I was the district attorney in Milwaukee County, I had 5 experienced assistant DAs, a close team, prosecuting termination of parental rights cases. I thought those were very serious cases. I wouldn't even think of sending in an inexperienced assistant to start there. I picked selected competent lawyers because I knew how complex those cases were. They were assisted by skilled social workers who collected the facts. Those were tough cases. To think, if I wouldn't trust an inexperienced assistant DA, how could a citizen appearing, trying to secure, to stop the termination of his parental rights to his daughter or his son or her son or daughter, how could that person be expected to competently represent their own interests in cases so complex that I used only skilled assistant DAs to prosecute those cases? The discussion has come up. I know where the practice in Milwaukee County. I can't imagine across this state, if people are appearing without counsel in those cases, I can't help but feel that major injustices. Who in this court that has a child can think of a case more important than the termination of the rights of that child? Can you present a more important case? I don't care if the largest building in the state of Wisconsin, the old First Wisconsin building, is changing hands. Is this a more serious legal business than what's happening out at Children's Court where someone's parental rights are being terminated? Who could compare the gravity of the two? And that should be across the state, should be fundamental that people have a right to speak out through a competent lawyer to challenge the termination of parental rights cases. Since I've retired, I've pretty much stayed away from the law. I'm not going to talk about charity, but doing charity, but I joined the St. Vincent de Paul Society. One of their things is people call in with poverty problems, and they send it out. If you belong to most conferences or in a particular parish, and I've gone out to over 200 homes. I shouldn't say homes, apartments. I've never been in a home on one of these calls. They have needs. They need bed. They need furniture. They need food. They need electric bills and so on. And I've gone out to about 200-plus homes, I would estimate, in the last 4.5 years and seen real poverty in neighborhoods that I didn't believe existed that badly. I knew there weren't rich neighborhoods, but particularly women, sometimes with 2 or 3 or 4 children in the home, no food, no beds, no kitchen table, no chairs, many times not well-educated. And I think of those persons articulately representing their rights, particularly in shelter issues, tenancy disputes, they aren't up to it. And they don't have a dime to put food on the table. How can they ever get a lawyer in to represent them? And yet to be without shelter. I am not engaged in that work of the society, but the society also helps homeless people, provides food to homeless people, or even in more desperate shape. So I think it's so profoundly important. Chief Justice, you adverted a little earlier about the fact that our state anticipated Gideon by decades. It must have been a proud day for lawyers. The justices that made that decision must have addressed the antipathy of local county boards that said, what the heck are you doing for this defendant, this mugger, this thief, this burglar, this rapist, this murderer, and you're guaranteeing representation of that guy? What's wrong with you? It must have been an unpopular decision. I can't believe it wasn't.
They made a lot of them that year.
Pardon?
They made a lot of unpopular decisions sure. that year.
Well, I know they're tough decisions. We all make tough decisions. And I urge you, I think this is a vitally important issue. I think it touches upon the quality of justice. Who is entrusted with protecting the quality of justice other than the seven people who sit at this bench right now? Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. McCann. I think I'm going to take off the word retired from you. Attorney Tom Cannon, Executive Director, Milwaukee Legal Aid Society. Mr. Cannon.
Thank you. Chief Justice and members of the court, my name is Tom Cannon. I'm Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, one of America's oldest public interest law firms. We were founded in 1916 with a unique charter to do all things necessary for the prevention of injustice. And toward that end, every year, we provide free legal services to 8,000 of Milwaukee County's poorest and most vulnerable residents. I'm going to scrap my prepared remarks this afternoon and cut to the quick. I'd like to address three precise issues here. The first is Justice Ziegler's perceptive question, which is, who pays? Ideally, the state of Wisconsin should pay. This is a statewide legal problem that you are being called on to address. A couple of weeks ago, the Census Bureau figures were released for poverty statistics of the state of Wisconsin. 731,000 people in all 72 counties of the state have incomes below the federal poverty level. Those whose incomes are 125% of the federal poverty level are entitled to free legal services under general rules governing legal action of Wisconsin Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. That probably bumps the 731,000 figure up close to a million. We also have grants from the federal government that are targeted at low-income people. For example, community development block grants we get from the city and the county. They have 250% of the federal poverty guidelines. So how many people has the federal government determined are eligible for free legal services in the state of Wisconsin? Nobody knows for sure, but my best guess, somewhere between 1.5 million and 2 million out of a total population of 5 million people. This is a statewide problem. It affects every one of the 72 counties in the state. It demands a statewide solution. You have been charged with running a statewide court system under the terms of the state constitution. The circuit judges are in the state constitution. Every county in the state has a state circuit court. And there is a precedent in Wisconsin for the state paying for the legal services to the poor. In 1977, the state legislature adopted the State Public Defender Program, taking over from the counties the responsibility for providing free lawyers for poor people in criminal cases. And history demonstrates that the legislature follows the courts. question has been raised today about lack of funds. This has a familiar ring to it. When the United States Supreme Court decided the Gideon case in 1963, states and counties said, where is the money going to come from for us to fund lawyers for poor people in felony cases? The U.S. Supreme Court did not address that issue. They articulated the right to counsel in a felony case. The states and the local governments found the money to provide counsel. In 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court said juveniles have a right to a lawyer in juvenile delinquency proceedings. Again, the states and the counties said, where's the money going to come from? They found the money. In 1971, the Supreme Court decided Argersinger v. Hamlin, right to counsel in misdemeanor cases. Again, the same refrain, where is the money coming from? All 50 states or their local government units found the money to provide counsel. It's really not, from my point of view, a lack of funding, it's a lack of will. Wisconsin found a way to build a $400 million baseball stadium in Milwaukee. They passed a state sales tax enforced in a particular area of the state to raise the money for Miller Park. Wisconsin found a way to finance $295 million remodeling of Lambeau Field in Green Bay, same way. Wisconsin found a way to finance the deep tunnel sewerage project in Milwaukee County, $1.6 billion. Wisconsin found a way to rebuild the Marquette interchange in Milwaukee County, $1 billion. Is justice less important than baseball? Is justice less important than football? Is justice less important than efficient transportation? Justice is a core function of every government since time began. Even primitive warlords establish a system of justice because they recognize you cannot govern without addressing this core function.
Mr. Cannon?
Yes.
You're going to complete very quickly. Your red light's on, please.
Oh, okay. Justice Rogensack asked a couple of questions about picking a particular area. I urge the court not to think small, not to act timidly. Remember the words of John Paul Jones, fortune favors the bold. Thinking small is only going to hurt the poor and the disabled of this state. Last week, a family showed up in our office in Children's Court, an unusual family, intact, mother, father, married, 8 children, all from the same father. The father had lost his job. He worked outside the home supporting the family. The mother worked inside the home raising the 8 kids. Because the income flow stopped, the father lost the job, couldn't pay the mortgage. They had to move out of the family home. They moved in with the in-laws. The in-laws, after a short period of time, couldn't accommodate, and the landlord decided he couldn't accommodate 10 extra people living in this apartment unit. He evicted them. The parents bring the 8 kids to the Legal Aid Society's Children's Court office and say, we want to terminate parental rights to our 8 kids because we simply cannot afford to raise them. Now, if this court adopts a rule that is focused just on children's court or termination of parental rights, it's not going to be sufficient. Poverty does not recognize need to jurisdictional lines. In this case, the father may have a claim for unemployment compensation. He may have a claim for illegal discharge from his employment. There may be a defense to the mortgage foreclosure action. These are very complicated, complex legal problems. And if we solve those problems, the children's court issue goes away. As one of the speakers said this morning, Mr. Greco, the failure to provide legal counsel will cost more in terms of social benefits down the road. Last point, just ask the court to take the long view of history. In the 13th century, judges in England took it upon themselves to appoint counsel for poor people. 200 years later, 1424, 1494, Parliament in Scotland and England enacts two statutes, the Poor Advocate Statute and the Statute of Henry VII, which codifies what the judges did over the course of the previous 200 years. Again, proving the point, the legislatures always follow the courts. I close by simply saying that sometime down the road, a legal historian is going to review what this court did or did not do today. I urge you to be on the side of history in recognizing in a meaningful way this emerging civil right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The Reverend John Jacobs.
Chief Justice Abramson, thank you for the opportunity, justices, to speak before you. The first non-lawyer attorney to be at the podium today feels rather strange. You've already heard many compelling arguments for this petition, and so I provide a different perspective from my experience, and I want to share that with you, and I appreciate the opportunity to do so. And my personal perspective is based on the way in which we live in human societies. I'm reminded of an attorney by the name of Gamaliel, first century Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, who protected the life of St. Peter, somebody who's important to somebody like me and some other folks in the room, as we think about how we work together in human communities. So I know today that many people depend on the circuit court system to decide civil claims that affect their lives. And we must understand that I think many people who even walk into these buildings are incredibly intimidated because they have no experience, no sense of power or authority. What will they think of me, they say? Will they even understand my accent? How do I keep from losing my house? Some people, from my experience then, working with them, never even show up. They simply give up. The intimidation is too great. There is no time that they can take from their minimum wage job that they got from some temporary agency to even go to court. How can they do that? And how can they be assured that somebody will even hear their side of the story? They have no say. They have no power. These series of events then lead to a very costly intervention system. Social services, negotiations by third party, pastors, outreach workers, systems that are set up to help the indigent, who also have limited resources, then must reach out and help these people. Now, these resources will continue to be used no matter what you decide today, and there will be this street-level justice that continues to be meted out. But how much better could it be if we act as partners? Wouldn't it be more humane and more ethical and more financially prudent if we can improve the cooperation between what happens at the street level and what might happen if this petition were granted? The expense and the eventual disruption of basic human needs
would be mitigated in such a way that people might be able to use some of their resources to feed their families and to look for a better job or to deal with that educational loan. And perhaps families could avoid costly eviction or foreclosure or bankruptcy. When a litigant cannot represent oneself and walks away from a conflict because the litigant has determined, without the help of a court-appointed attorney, that the only solution is to abandon the case, as I said, the cost is immense to our society. Now, at our level, at the street level, we are morally obligated to meet the needs of these people. That's the mandate of our faith, and that's the mandate of what it means to be a human being in this world. And this will always be the case. As our judicial system, the precedents, the rules, and the procedures continue to evolve, I think that in some cases it might become less accessible for the people who need it most. And so I think that there needs to be then that opportunity for that attorney to be appointed at the discretion of the judge to help our fellow citizens in cases that scare them to death, that are so complicated they don't even want to walk through the door. Because it is in that way, in assisting people who don't have the resources, that we understand that we practice living in a fair and just community. So it is my position that a positive ruling on this petition would be a step in a just and prudent direction in a society that we share as we value humanity and fairness and justice. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Reverend. And you're at the Ascension Lutheran Church in Milwaukee, is that correct?
I am. It's a congregation that does worship in three different languages. It's an old church, 160 years old in Milwaukee. It started out as an immigrant church 160 years ago, and we still are. And many people in our congregation really struggle through the system, and it is a cost. Not only our congregation, but many congregations. And many people in this room, you are involved in those kinds of ministries that help people through the system. And so we appreciate your help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine, is it Husenga? Shalom Center Interfaith Network in Kenosha.
Hello. Thank you. I'm glad to be here in person today, because I do believe in this petition. I work at a center that we have four programs in the one center. We have a food pantry that we serve 950 households a month now. We have a soup kitchen that's open 375 days a year that we feed about 100 to 200 people a night. We have a family shelter that the list is so long we can't even keep up with it, where people live upstairs. We have an INS program. That's where people go and sleep at different churches every night. There's a cap to every church, so it goes from 50 to 35 people. That's always full. So I just want to say that's what I do for a living. And in that living, it is not uncommon on a daily basis to talk with someone going through a great deal of difficulty. Either they have lost their apartment or their house, or they had lost their HUD housing. They are hungry, they lost their food stamps. In some cases, they even lose their children. They have no money, they have no job. They don't have a license, they don't have no money to get back their licenses. They don't have insurance to pay for the car if they even had a license. And their gas and electric bill is so high they can't even get an apartment to try to catch up with their gas and electric bill. And I believe that people, before they are rolled to the situation where they come to us, that it's so difficult to get them back on their feet, because we now have to clothe them, we have to furnish their apartment, we have to give them so many new skills of uplifting their hope that it's going to be okay. It takes almost a year. It's not they can't, they stay in shelter for a month no more. That's ridiculous. They have to stay in there at least 4 months, and that's a good case. So, and then we, you know, you have to refurnish all their clothes or kids' clothes. They lost everything. They're in shelter. And you can't put anything in storage. Storage units are almost as much as a rent. So I really think if they got proper counsel with their housing or their counsel of their HUD housing before they lost it, they would not be in our situation where we have to help them reestablish everything because they lost everything. So that's why I do believe in this. Also, in our economic difficulty, our agency is witnessing more and more in of this. These situations, and I think one of the hardest things to do for me is to turn somebody away that is in desire need, either it be shelter, food, clothing, medical, or equal justice for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hazenka. Liz Marquardt, Sojourner Family Peace Center, Milwaukee. It's good seeing you again.
Good seeing you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
As you said, I'm from Sojourner Family Peace Center. We see tens of thousands of victims and their children with a variety of programs, but I'm not going to talk about our agency. I want to talk briefly about the additional barriers that victims of domestic violence face. A lot of the speakers have talked about barriers in general for unrepresented litigants, but for domestic violence victims who survive by analyzing and reanalyzing their options, weighing their choices, and considering the risks and benefits of leaving their abusers, it's really overwhelming. They ask themselves, what's the safest thing for me to do? What's possible? And what's realistic? And unquestionably, we know that they fare better in this analysis and in court when they have legal advice and representation. Some unrepresented victims are not aware of their rights. They don't know what remedies are available to them, and they don't know how to invoke protection of those rights if they're violated. As the Reverend said, some just simply give up and don't even try to get the remedies available to them. They're often put in the position of making terrible choices. They're forced to choose between being safe and having financial support, being safe and having a roof over their heads, being safe and keeping custody of their children. And these are horrific choices. Abusers gain and maintain power and control using physical and sexual violence, isolation, emotional manipulation, intimidation, and threats. Specifically, they threaten that if the victim leaves, they will lose their home, their sustenance, their children, and sometimes their life. And all too often, these are not idle threats. This reality is really unacceptable. All over the state, there are domestic violence programs with lay advocates for domestic violence victims. When a lay advocate recognizes that the legal issues are too complex or the other barriers to self-representation are too great and their client needs a lawyer, there's too often not one available. And this is a tragedy. Abusers use threats and intimidation to keep the upper hand. Fear and the lingering effects of trauma exacerbate the difficulty most unrepresented litigants experience when one has also been abused. For unrepresented victims, the playing field is not a level one. The price to families and communities is simply too high. While there is a human cost of continued abuse to both the victim and the children exposed to it, I also agree with Judge Trajano that the greatest cost is on the back end. What I mean by that is that it impacts all of our systems. Children exposed to abuse increase the cost of our educational system, child protection system, and the juvenile justice system. There's a cost to health care, to treat injuries and chronic abuse-related conditions. There's the cost of continued need for law enforcement, prosecution response, criminal courts, and corrections. There's the cost of domestic violence in homeless shelters and other social services. And, of course, there's also the cost to the civil courts of processing cases with unrepresented litigants that's been referenced. To answer Justice Rogensack's question, if I had to choose where the greatest need and the greatest potential damage that's currently playing out for victims of domestic violence, I'd have to say in child custody matters. Too often, abusers use the family courts as a mechanism to control victims and as a weapon. And this should offend us all.
Do you see child custody disputes as more pressing need than having an attorney, as Judge Trigiano did in the domestic abuse injunction phase of this?
Well, I think she was saying that when there is domestic violence, there's a greater need for the appointment of counsel, and it plays out both in injunction court and in family court, and they're often happening simultaneously. So really, as someone earlier said, we do need to have comprehensive assessment of what the legal needs are.
We had comprehensive money. I doubt you'd have much of an argument.
I agree. So earlier you acknowledged that the courts already have the authority to appoint counsel, and the discussion was about directing them to do so when the rights to basic needs are at stake. And I think that's important rather than undertaking a pilot project, and I understand it's also a fiscal issue, but I urge you to consider those issues, those points. Questions?
You sit on the Access to Justice Commission?
I sit on the Access to Justice Commission, yes. And I sat on your pro se. I sat on your pro se committee.
Right. I saw that in 2000.
A very long time ago. I'm not even sure if I had the same name then.
No, you do, because I checked the list to see who was still active in the field, and quite a number were.
Right. Yes, I've been at some incarnation of the agency I currently work for 24 years, Chief.
Okay.
I know I don't look old enough to be.
No. We are all in iteration and reiteration.
Yes, thank you, Chief.
Right. Thank you.
I'm not sure I'm understanding your testimony. I thought I heard you say that there is a risk that child custody could be transferred to the abuser. Is that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think. And,
could you give sort of a narrative description?
I think abusers threaten that if you leave me, I'm going to take the children. And they use the legal system as their mechanism for doing that. And a lot of times, the conditions of being abused make it look like that parent is less capable because maybe they've moved for safety reasons, maybe they don't have access to funds because the abuser is well-resourced, and the victim loses access to those resources when she leaves the abuser, most often she, but not always. So it plays out that sometimes what happens is, what the Reverend said, she just goes back, risks her own safety, because the risk of losing the children is just too great. So it's a really terrible choice that people find themselves having to make.
When the abuser has means, does the court require the abuser to pay the attorney?
Well, if there's depends. I'm going to answer like a lawyer. That depends.
Depends on what?
It depends on the court, the circumstances, whether or not they're married, whether or not she's got access to those resources, what kind of litigation it is. A lot of my clients don't have well-resourced abusers. A lot of them also are being abused by other poor people, but it's much
by
other poor people, by other people without resources, but it's really complicated. Let's say, for instance, that the abuser is a law enforcement officer. Then you add layers and layers of knowledge of the system that the victim doesn't have and the abuser does, the resources from a steady job. It just gets really complicated. And a lot of victims do just simply give up and not try to access the remedies available to them, particularly if they're unrepresented, which most of them are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mitch Agopian. Disability rights. I had Lynn Breedlove, but you're taking her spot. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. May it please the Court, my name is Mitch Agopian. I'm an attorney with Disability Rights Wisconsin. Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the Court, thank you for allowing us to testify in support of establishing a right to legal counsel in certain civil cases. Disability Rights Wisconsin is a designated protection and advocacy agency for people with disabilities in Wisconsin. Our federal mission is to advocate on behalf of people with disabilities in all forums. Our legal advocacy is accomplished with a combination of attorneys, advocacy specialists, and counselors. In 2010, we were able to directly serve approximately 2,300 clients with disabilities. We represent clients in public benefits matters like Medicaid, Medicare, and SSI, employment discrimination cases, special education disputes, guardianship protective placement matters, and access to medical treatment by disabled prisoners. Much of that advocacy is done in administrative settings. These are areas that are, of course, crucially important to the lives of people with disabilities and areas where private representation, at any price, is difficult to come by. Our agency could never meet the additional demand for legal services that currently confronts people with disabilities, particularly in the areas that are addressed by this petition. We do not have the resources to provide representation to poor, disabled people who are in court facing eviction, utility shutoffs, abusive collection activities, divorce or child custody disputes. Others have spoken far more eloquently of the need for all indigent people to have legal counsel in these matters, and we echo those statements. But for people with disabilities, the need is even more acute. Poverty is only one of the many obstacles that make the justice system intimidating and inaccessible. For people with physical disabilities, there are architectural obstacles. For people with sensory disabilities, there are impediments to communication and full participation in the proceedings. And people with cognitive impairments or mental illness are singularly ill-equipped to handle the intellectual challenges and stresses created by interaction with the legal system. The system is bewildering, and they are often incapable of navigating it. Our constituency needs lawyers, and they cannot afford them in many cases. That is because disability is highly correlated to poverty. According to the U.S. Census, in 2010, the national poverty rate among people with disabilities aged 18 to 64 was a staggering 27.9%, up from 25% in just 2009. And people with disabilities constituted 15.9% of all 18 to 64-year-olds in poverty. The rate is obviously much higher among people with disabilities who earn less than 200% of the federal poverty threshold, the people that would be covered by this petition. One area where we often see a need for representation is in CHIPS proceedings, which have been discussed at various points throughout the day today. In many cases, particularly it seems when the parent is a person with a cognitive disability, CHIPS proceedings are initiated as a precursor to eventual termination of parental rights. Parenting ability is an area where, sadly, much suspicion of people with disabilities remains. We are aware of cases where parents with cognitive impairments have substantially complied with conditions set by the county for reunification, only to be told that new conditions have been imposed. Because these parents have no legal representation and are cognitively impaired, they have little ability to recognize this due process violation and less ability to articulate it effectively. Meanwhile, their adversary, the county, has the considerable resources of the Corporation Counsel or District Attorney's Office and Child Protective Services at its disposal. No one can say that a fair fight ensues or that the adversary system serves the disabled parent adequately under these circumstances. This problem is made worse because one of the grounds for terminating parental rights is a failure to comply with CHIPS conditions resulting in an out-of-home placement for 6 months. While a parent in a TPR does have the right to counsel, by then it is often too late to salvage the situation. Competent legal representation during the CHIPS phase of the proceedings assures that conditions imposed in the CHIPS phase were possible for the disabled parent to meet. Your decision in Joni B. found a legislative prohibition on court-appointed counsel in CHIPS proceedings unconstitutional and directed the CHIPS courts to exercise discretion in deciding whether to appoint counsel in order to assure due process. Judge Donegan and Judge Yamahiro this morning talked about this, and apparently it isn't a major problem in Milwaukee County, which is a blessing. But it is a problem in other counties because we get calls about this on a fairly regular basis. The case of Tina H. is an example. Tina's three children were the subject of CHIPS actions by the county. She came to us many months after the actions were commenced and after her children had been removed from her home for over 6 months. She was cognitively impaired with a full-scale IQ of 64. Her sole source of income was SSI, which provides a recipient with an income that is less than 100% of the federal poverty line. She had attempted to comply with reunification requirements set by the county and had exercised her visitation rights throughout the CHIPS process. She had even requested counsel, But that request had been denied without a hearing. We contacted the court on her behalf and requested that the judge exercise his discretion and appoint counsel. He did. The irony is that it took a lawyer to get the court to appoint a lawyer. But from Tina's perspective, the damage had already been done. By the time she got a lawyer, the county had initiated TPR proceedings, which her appointed counsel was unsuccessful in preventing. The TPR decision was eventually overturned on appeal in a proceeding in which Tina was represented by counsel. Had the instant petition been in effect, perhaps that trial judge would have felt compelled to investigate Tina's circumstances earlier and appointed counsel more timely. This is just one example where disabled people need legal representation but cannot get it because they are too poor to afford a lawyer. The petition before you will go a long way towards rectifying the injustices that befall unrepresented litigants in a system founded on the assumption that both parties to a lawsuit have access to competent counsel. This court has a history of taking bold action to further the cause of ensuring equal access to the courts for poor people. It took courage to levy the $50 wage staff assessment on the lawyers of the state. But it was the right thing to do, and I can tell you that it helped. As an employee of one of the legal services providers that benefits from that assessment, I'm here to thank you today. On behalf of people with disabilities in Wisconsin, we urge you to take the next bold step in this cause and adopt the proposed amendment to Supreme Court Rule 11.02 and require courts to appoint counsel under the limited circumstances set forth therein. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hagopian. David Callender, Legislative Associate, Wisconsin Counties Association. Mr. Callender.
Thank you.
We have your letter, too.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the court. You already do have a memo from me regarding this issue. I just wanted to address a few of the points that have come up during the discussions today. First of all, I want to reiterate that the Wisconsin Counties Association takes no position on the underlying issue of when and whether it is appropriate to appoint counsel or to expand the role of counsel, appointed counsel in civil matters. That ultimately, you've heard the arguments on that. That is not something that we specifically want to address. But what we do want to address particularly is in the process of determining who it is that pays for this and how these costs are allocated. That is the difficulty that we face. In terms of the issue of representation, WCA has worked very closely, for example, with the Access to Justice Commission and its chair, who is the county board chairman of Eau Claire. And as a county board chairman himself, I think that Greg Moore understands the huge financial impact that this proposal would have on counties if the court were to expand the appointment of counsel in civil matters. Earlier today, you did hear testimony from one of the judges in Milwaukee County who indicated that the issue of paying for this service is not his job. Unfortunately, for Wisconsin's counties, that is our job, and that is the role that we have to play in this process. And I believe Justice Ziegler asked a number of very important questions in terms of the kinds of decisions that counties have to make. We are, our county board members, our administrators, our executives are in the position of having to make the decision over the allocation of funds. And we are in crisis right now in terms of the kinds of funding decisions that we have to make. We are operating under the most stringent levy limits that have been imposed on us yet. As you are aware of the state's financial condition, there have been a number of county programs and state funding for county programs that have been reduced in this budget by 5% or 10%. And we are serving many of the same populations that are requiring this type of these types of court services. Specifically, I guess, I wanted to talk about three areas particularly, and the reason that we oppose this rule as it is constructed right now. First of all, we still don't know what the cost is going to be. The cost is unknown, and it could be huge. Whether we take the number that we were talking about, that the petitioners talked about in terms of the $56 million, or whether there is some additional number that we don't know how much it's going to be. And as I addressed in the memorandum, we're still talking about very broad definitions. And I think, Justice Rogenczak, in terms of the kinds of questions that you were asking about, is there a particular area to which we could be concentrating the provision of these services? Really, it's very difficult to address that question because, as I think it's become clear in the testimony that's been presented today, there are so many areas that become intertwined. And when you talk about there being one area, then there are other areas that feed into it. So that and when you talk about, for example, an eviction case or a child custody case or something like that, there are so many ancillary issues that are involved in that that we simply can't block off one particular area and say this is the one area where we're going to concentrate on providing these legal services.
Let me interject.
Yes.
Milwaukee County apparently has done that thus far with regard to their CHIPS cases that we heard this morning. What's the problem of expanding that program statewide?
I'm not sure, and I'll be honest with you, Justice, I'm not as familiar with the Milwaukee County program as I could be. However, the issue is that, as Milwaukee County pointed out, if you talk about expanding the kinds of services that are covered, beyond that, in Milwaukee County's own case, it would be $11 million. And I think they've been able to deal with those certain cases, and they've developed a process with that. Maybe that is something that we can look at, but we have to come up with a funding source that comes from something other than the counties. And so I think that's one of the things that certainly we would be willing to work with the court in terms of its request to the legislature in the next budget cycle.
Why is the assumption that the county will pay when the circuit court makes the appointment? The circuit court's a state officer.
This is true. However, absent any appropriation by the legislature for the provision of these services, ultimately a court-ordered service becomes the responsibility of the county. And that is really the nature of what our the crux of our opposition to this is that
money.
Right,
yeah, we
is
understand
money,
that.
And is that if the legislature doesn't appropriate the money to provide these services, then ultimately it's the counties that have to pay. And standing here before you representing the Wisconsin Counties Association, I can tell you, when we talk to our county members, the money simply is not there. And if the money is going to have to be appropriated for this purpose, it's going to have to come from other services, and it's going to have to come in all likelihood from other court services. I did want to also talk about, in terms of the provision that the petitioners make for using the court services surcharge. The court has been very good in terms of trying to get that money back for its original purpose, which was to pay for the operation of the court system.
The court and the Wisconsin County Association have worked together long and hard and unsuccessfully.
But we appreciate your efforts. We appreciate the court's efforts very much. And so it's unfortunate from our standpoint that we have someone now that is making yet another claim on funding that we had hoped would go to the actual court operations. If we could get that back instead of going to the general fund into our court operations, then that would be a significant improvement for our fiscal position.
Mr. Callender, what if this court were to adopt the petition and to delay implementation for a period of about 2 years until there was another budget cycle with the legislature, allowing for the opportunity for planning by the individual counties and the county association? Would that be something that might be appropriate for this court to consider?
Justice, I guess the best way that I have to address that is that, again, we are dependent on the appropriations of the legislature. And absent an appropriation by the legislature, that has to come out of the county coffers. And that is the difficulty. And unfortunately, right now, I think it's very difficult to predict what the fiscal situation for the state is going to be. I can certainly tell you that the fiscal horizon for counties at this point is still very bleak. And again, I mean, when we talk about it, we're still talking about two pots of revenue, really, for counties. We're talking about sales tax revenues, and we're talking about property tax revenues. Our levies are limited to 0% or the increase in equalized valuation. Right now, we're seeing decreases in equalized valuation. So we're seeing very, very difficult times for our counties. And we are serving the populations that this proposal is actually aimed at. If we have to make choices about this, the same populations that we're attempting to help will be hurt.
Any other questions? Justice Brass.
Mr. Callender, there have been, we've received some suggestions that the court not pass a blanket rule, but try to develop a pilot program in some county. Any reaction to that?
I think we would certainly be happy to talk to you and to discuss it. And I guess the question is just simply if we can find a county that would be available to do something like that. And, the real questions on this really are what are the parameters going to be? What types of cases, how do we determine, the appropriation level for it, and what are the costs going to be? And I think we have been trying to work through this in terms of the Access to Justice Commission. That is something that we've been working with, that we presented to our board. But I think it's a very, very difficult time for counties. I really can't overemphasize that in this presentation. Also, one thing in terms of a scheduling note, I did want to let you know also that Andy Phillips, who is our WCA legal counsel, will not be appearing. And so I, in the spirit of this proceedings, I am appearing pro se.
Well, because non-appearance is bad news and good news, as you will understand.
May I also ask, there's a recurrent theme here that if counsel were provided in many situations, it would actually lead to lesser costs for government entities in the long run, and maybe even in the short run. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, first of all, that's very hard for us to assess, and I think it's very hard to assess prospectively. I think if we had an opportunity to examine what happens in California, for example, with their program there, that might be instructive in terms of what possible savings we have here. I mean, that's always an argument that's made, is that if we can reduce the front-end savings, that there will always be back-end savings in the long run. And again, that's something where we don't know. We don't know exactly what kind of long-term cost savings there would be, or when we would be able to recover those savings, or if, for example, those savings would even be passed on to the counties. That's the difficulty that we have with trying to project that.
Problem often is that it's in the future, and you got to put up the money now.
Right.
And number two is what you just said. You might find savings in the school system,
right,
which doesn't necessarily come to county money.
Right.
Or that it's in some other budget and it doesn't come into the county. So then having that other entity give up the savings or pass out the savings becomes a difficulty.
That's very true, yes.
We see that in the Department of Corrections issues where they might save money, but that it's at the earlier stage at county or law enforcement that the money is spent extra.
And with no disrespect to the legislature, it's been the county's experience quite frequently that whatever savings we're able to achieve somehow do not end up remaining with the counties.
Justice Prosser?
My final question, Mr. Callender, is the county's association has a brain trust, of which you're part. Have you folks been sitting around trying to come up with some ideas of where to get money for something like this, or is this not your highest priority?
At the moment, our efforts have been to try to restore the funding that was cut in the budget for the existing programs. For example, one of the things that concerns us, and this is, again, when we talk about court-ordered costs, is that there has now been a cap placed on enrollment in family care.
Cap on what?
On enrollment in the family care.
Enrollment
program.
In family care, right. That is not by the court,
yes.
I assume.
I'm sorry?
That's not a court.
This is not a court-ordered program.
Right, okay.
But the family care program is something that helps disabled individuals to live in the community, and it provides long-term care services for those individuals. If there is a cap on enrollment in those programs, there are individuals who can then petition the court to be placed ahead of the waiting list. And so, again, we're talking about court-ordered, court-mandated services that counties must provide. And, again, we're still talking about the same populations in many respects as the petitioners that are here before us today.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Count? Justice Brasser?
Well, let me try once more. If you were sitting up here,
yes,
and you were impressed by the case that was being made for legal services for at least some of these problems, what would the county's association do for an answer?
I think from the standpoint of the county's association, we might go to perhaps a seasoned former legislator and who has had experience with the budget process and that has been in leadership and that is familiar with the issues. And we might seek the advice of that seasoned former legislator as to what potentially the most the best strategy would be for something like that, sir.
Okay.
I'm not trying to be flip, but I think the question is really for counties specifically. We are trying to fund the services that we have, and we are trying to fund a variety of basic services for vulnerable populations. We are trying to, at this point, restore funding, for example, simply for collection of child support enforcement. We're trying to absorb the cuts that we have already taken. So to try to contemplate providing new services at this point and in this environment is one that is exceptionally difficult for us.
You're not even able to hang on to what you're doing.
That's exactly correct.
That's really your position.
We are
hanging on. Lost money, the 10%, which came out of your budget.
Right.
Have you thought about taxes?
If you'd like to, we have thought about taxes. As you know, we have very limited discretion in terms of the taxes that we can levy.
I understand that.
No.
Any other? Thank you very much, Mr. Callender. And I was sorry, now we're not hearing from Mr. Phillips.
That's correct.
He did a very good pro se job. Marcia Mansfield.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Abramson and members of the court. It is my honor to be here today representing the Access to Justice Commission. Mr. Callender referenced Greg Moore, who is the chair of the commission, who could not be here today. He's also the county board chair. You know, Claire, I don't think he sent me here as a sacrificial lamb to talk about funding, which is not why I'm here. I am here to tell you that the Access to Justice Commission has voted unanimously and unequivocally to support this petition. We could do no other because the principles underlying this petition are really fundamental to the mission and core values of the Access to Justice Commission. And we stand ready to assist the court in any way that we can, whether it is engaging in research of alternate sources of funding. The Chief Justice mentioned CyPRAE awards, and in fact, we have a committee that's looking into CyPRAE awards right now because that is an issue that is being looked at as a source of funding across the country, whether it's punitive damages, whether it's helping the court to design a pilot project, or provide research on other models throughout the country. We are happy to do so. We want to be creative and engage in a process to make this a reality. Other than that, I really have little to say that the 21 people who preceded me have not already said to you. I just want to, though of course being a lawyer, have to say a couple more things. That is, Chief Justice went through a long list of wonderful accomplishments that this court has engaged in and pushed forward to help litigants who otherwise would not have a lawyer, be it funding the $50 assessment or the self-help clinics in courthouses or the online forms that are accessible. I don't look at those things, Chief, as a Band-Aid. I look at those as part of a coordinated system of civil justice, and they help people. Those courthouse clinics help people. Those forms help people. Those are all tools that people can use to access the justice system. And sometimes those are enough. There are some people who that's all they need. They need help with a form. They need to understand what's going to happen at a hearing, and they can sail through on their own. But those are not the people that we are here today to talk about. We are talking about the people that really do need the help of a lawyer in order to successfully present their case. Not win or lose, but just be able to fully develop the facts and the law necessary to have a full decision rendered. And so that's why we on the Access to Justice Commission are supporting this petition and stand ready to assist in any way we can. Thank you.
I have a question.
Mrs. Bradley.
Thank you. What do you understand the petition to do? You may not have a copy of it in front of you, but it indicates where a civil litigant is indigent, and that's defined as below 200% of federal poverty guidelines, the court shall provide counsel at public expense where the assistance of counsel is needed to protect the litigant's rights to basic human needs, including sustenance, shelter, clothing, heat, medical care, safety, child custody, and placement. And then it goes on in making the determination what you can consider. That first sentence, I mean, if this was one of my relatives or one of my close friends, I can't imagine them that I would advise them to go to court without an attorney. And so does this mean that in all of these categories, we are indicating the court shall provide counsel? What's your understanding of the scope of this petition?
My understanding is that the two paragraphs have to be read conjunctively. That is, the court shall appoint counsel if, after exercising discretion and going through these factors, the court decides that counsel is appropriate.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, one of my concerns. I understand they are read together. The first one says the court shall, if needed, and the second one says this is what you consider in determining if needed. But in these areas, I just can't, it's hard for me to expect anything other than the overwhelming majority they're going to be needed. That's why I use my example of my family or my friends. I can't imagine them when a basic right like this is in question that I wouldn't advise and say to them, you need an attorney. I mean, what do you know, do you know the rules of evidence? Do you know the rules of civil procedure? You need an attorney.
My students in my program at the law school are at the courthouse on almost a daily basis, mm-hmm. and in the family law area. So we see hundreds of people each year walk through the doors and seek our help. And many of them need no more than the assistance with the form. And many of them need, I mean, a simple divorce does not, I'm going to get shot from the back because the lawyers who think that you need a lawyer for everything, I don't agree with that. Oftentimes in a simple divorce, somebody can go in, fill out the paperwork. There's no dispute.
But this doesn't cover these eight categories don't cover simple divorce. Maybe it's included in a divorce, but then it's not so simple if child custody is an issue or placement is an issue. That's what those
so
are two.
So the woman who walks into our clinic who hasn't seen their child for 5 years and can't figure out what she needs to do in order to get to court to see her child would be the kind of person that I would probably say, if I could, I think you need a lawyer. And that person would have to go to court and have the judge look at the factors and determine whether or not she sees a lawyer. But there are many cases, Justice Bradley, that are going to require that, are going to require the judge to look at the facts of the case, but there are many that do not. And I really don't think that the courthouse is going to be overwhelmed with indigent individuals who are seeking court a determination whether or not they need a lawyer in a particular case. I'm only basing that on my experience in handling the volume of people that walk through our doors.
Would you agree with Justice Bradley's reading that the circuit court shall appoint a lawyer if these factors in these cases point to the need for a lawyer? It isn't shall appoint a lawyer for every indigent in all of these cases.
If the judge, after weighing the factors, makes a determination that a lawyer is appropriate, right. Yes.
But you have to weigh the factors before that's, the shall.
I think that's what the word shall means, yes.
Your clinical program, could you describe it a little bit, please?
Certainly, Justice Prosser. Our clinic operates at the Dane County Courthouse, and people come in with any sort of family law problem. The students there are trained to give information, to answer questions, to explain the court process, to help them work through a form. They don't give legal advice. So they help in up until the point where someone says to me, well, what should I say to the judge? We can't answer that. But we do help them with all other aspects of their proceeding that we can do without providing legal advice.
Well, could you extend that program for certain students to give legal advice, and could you have a pro bono requirement as part of the curriculum in the law in both law schools in the state?
Certainly, the law schools could require pro bono. The University of Wisconsin Law School has not gone there yet, but that other law schools across the country have done that. And actually, my clinic does provide legal representation in certain select cases, generally involving victims of domestic violence, but in other situations where we go through an evaluation and determine that the representation is really necessary for the individual. I don't advertise that, so don't tell anybody, because otherwise our doors, I mean, people would be breaking down our doors. We get referrals from the local domestic abuse intervention service here in Dane County. We also work very closely with a nonprofit law firm here that has a sliding scale fee arrangement with its clients to co-counsel on cases. So the students do that.
Would it be reasonable for this court to entertain the idea of a pro bono requirement for law students who graduate from the two Wisconsin law schools?
I think that such a requirement needs to come from within. It needs to come from within the law schools rather than externally being imposed upon them. Because you need the buy-in from the people who are on the faculty of that law school in order to encourage it and make it work. We've been very fortunate this year. We've had Ann Zimmerman, who used to work with all of you on the court, working in the law school and being the coordinator of our pro bono program, and she's only been here for 6 months, and she's already increased the visibility and involvement by attorneys and students in the pro bono program. So, you know, different kinds of investments. As I said, this is a coordinated effort. There are different kinds of investments in the delivery of legal services that can result in very positive implications for our society, but I don't think you can look at anything in isolation.
Well, it seems to me you're taking the position that the court should not impose anything on the law schools. It should just impose things on the counties. Is that right?
Well, we don't impose it. I mean, the bigger question is we don't impose it on our lawyers. And law school is a training for becoming a lawyer. Our model rule encourages it, but it does not require it. And that is a bigger issue with a lot of very strong feelings on all sides of the argument.
You ought to explain your new pro bono program, which just started, which is that the law students are encouraged to do pro bono. Doesn't count towards their degree. It's not in lieu of clinical, as I understand
That's
it.
That's exactly right.
You've got lawyers both in private practice and in government joining in and taking under their wing law students who do pro bono. So it encourages the bar to do pro bono, and increases the bar's pro bono services by giving, in effect, legal assistance through a law student.
You've described it very well.
I listened hard when it was described to me. And so this is just one program, but it's not a required program. But you need to do a required program. You need faculty support of such a program and administrative support, which is just another way of saying state support.
Correct.
At least at Madison, it would be private support at Marquette.
Private support at Marquette, which has a similar program.
And many years ago, the court had a program that required the these bar members, as best I remember it, to add up the number of pro bono hours and then report that. And they did that for 1 or 2 years. And it turned out to be a very large number. Although one of the problems, and I don't know how you're resolving it at the law school, was how to define pro bono, which is not easy. It doesn't mean just because you didn't get paid, because a lot of lawyers do law work and for one reason or other don't get paid or don't get paid a full bill.
That's correct.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Carlo Escueda, Dane County Circuit Court Clerk. Carlo?
He's not here.
He's not here. Okay, we're going to miss him. All right, anyone want to take his place? Hearing none, I go on to Sheila Reif.
Could I speak to him?
In his place.
Sir, come on.
I believe I was on the original list, too, but I kind of...
Tell me your name, sir.
Lonnie Wolf.
Yes, you're out of Gamey County Circuit Court Clerk. And is the Walworth County Circuit Court Clerk here?
No, she left also.
Good.
So we're cutting down on the numbers.
I shouldn't have said good. Good that I am informed is what I meant. All right.
Okay. As president of the Wisconsin Clerks of Circuit Courts Association, we had sent a letter in... response to the Supreme Court rule,
right.
10-08.
Right.
In opposition, we're not really, as the WCA, David Callender also mentioned, we're not in opposition to the
idea
of this. It's just a matter of mechanism. I happen to be in charge of the clerk of court's office and the judges. I do the budgets. I'm a numbers guy. I do the accounting. The executive tells me what my budget target is, I have to meet it somehow. Now, if we add additional cost to the county budgets, I don't know how we're going to, something else is going to have to be cut out of our budgets. I don't know what I would cut out. So it's mainly at this point because as it is written, it appears that the funding for the court-appointed attorneys would be initially borne by the counties, is the way it's stated in the, I believe, in the petition. So I'm just representing that where would we find the money for this? And if we look for, you know, in the future, the state giving us some funding, I mean, that's probably a long ways off. And is the legislature going to provide funding for this? I don't know, but if the court appoints an attorney and the county has to pay for it, I don't know where we're going to get the money from. I guess that's my concern. We're not opposed to the ideal of what's intended here to provide legal assistance to these people, but as bottom line, I don't know where the money would come from.
We understand that.
Okay.
And I did read the submission, and thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, Justice Prosser.
I don't know if you were here this morning when I asked whether the prohibition about employees of a clerk of court's office giving additional assistance, maybe even minor legal advice, or choose this form and not that form, is that something that should even be on the table, or should it not be on the table?
Well, we do provide assistance to the public coming to the counter as much as possible without giving legal advice, as I believe the Dane County you were talking about. You have a legal assistance area, too, in the county. We do provide assistance, and actually in family matters, Outagamie County does have a legal assistance. We have some attorneys that do pro bono work, and they do come in certain times during the week, and we notify people if you have questions about custody or your divorce or whatever, you can't afford an attorney. There are attorneys available at this particular time. So we have tried to provide assistance that way. And my staff will direct people kind of, you know, here are the forms. You can get them online. We have packets of forms they can pick up. We try to put definitions or instructions as much as possible for the layperson to figure out, but we can't tell them which form to use or what to put on it.
Did the court adopt several years ago? I've sort of forgotten. Didn't they mean we adopted guidelines or rules or assistance to the clerk's office as to what the clerks can and cannot do? As I remember it, the clerks are the first line where somebody coming into the courthouse, they go to the clerk's office. So you're the first ones who see a non-represented
That is
correct. Litigant. And so therefore you got the you were bombarded with the questions. And as I remember it, your offices had issues of you can't give legal advice, but you can't just stonewall them and say, I'm not going to do anything, I can't talk to you, I can't say anything. It's somewhere between.
It's a gray area.
Yeah, I just give you my name and serial number as clerk versus telling you exactly what to do in practicing law. And I thought we had some guidelines, which of course don't answer every single question in every single circumstance.
Correct. There are guidelines out there as far as what we can give people directions on and how far really we can go. There are documents that my staff uses to say, you know, how far can we go in giving people advice
and I've seen
instructions.
In clerks' offices, and I'm sorry, but I can't remember yours well enough, there's a sign that says, we don't give legal advice, and then there's a citation, and I'm assuming now that it's to that rule or guidelines or whatever we did. And then sometimes it even says, if you need legal advice, call. And then it may be a local county bar association number or
yes.
Could be a state bar number on referral. I just can't remember, and I'm not sure it's
yeah,
the
that
same
is correct. We do have signs in our office that state we cannot. We are not allowed to give legal advice, cite the statute, but we also do give them directions. You hear the
but
local
anything,
bar association
yeah.
or whatever, and the state law library will give assistance.
Yeah. And I've even seen, and on Tuesday afternoons at 3, lawyers are in the courthouse. I mean, not every courthouse is the same, of course, but that's what I remember.
Yes. You have a good memory.
Well, I've been quite impressed when I get to the courthouse and I see that sign and information as to where to go and have a public terminal with instructions about how to use the forms and...
Correct. We do have two terminals in our office that people can use to pull up the forms online. And
right.
So, yes.
Mm-hmm. No cost.
Correct. No cost.
Well, we're trying.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tony, is it Gibert or Gibert? Pardon me?
Gibert.
Policy Coordinator, Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence.
That's right. Thank you, and may it please the court, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony here today. As was said, my name is Tony Gibbart, and I'm with the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. WCADV is the statewide membership organization that represents and supports local domestic violence victim service providers in Wisconsin, and we strongly support this petition. Civil proceedings resulting from domestic violence, such as petitions for restraining orders, divorces, actions involving child custody, have grave and sometimes fatal consequences for victims of domestic violence. From our experiences and the experiences of our member programs, the lack of civil counsel for low-income individuals is one of the most serious obstacles to providing victims in Wisconsin with safety and justice. As Justice Rogensack referenced earlier this morning, in a criminal case, a low-income domestic abuse defendant will be provided with counsel at state or county expense. And while that's certainly an important right, what's at stake in most domestic violence cases is a misdemeanor, disorderly conduct, or battery charge, and possibly a term of probation. Certainly those are important interests, but I would suggest that they're no more important than the interest that is at stake when a victim and an abuser confront each other in a child custody case. That process will determine the future safety of children who are already at risk because they've been exposed to violence. It will also determine how and if a victim of domestic violence will be legally forced to interact with her abuser while those children are still legally children before they become legal adults.
With the people your agency serves, how many don't have children?
Well, we're not a direct service provider. We represent all of the local agencies that do.
Okay.
And I don't have that figure in front of me, but I'd be happy to provide it to the court.
I was just curious because we're always talking about assistance to the women who have children and the concerns that are raised there. And I was just curious as to whether pretty much all of the women that come through and are provided assistance or not providing assistance have children in the home. So.
Certainly it's not all. I would expect that it mirrors the general population because
okay.
domestic violence is something that affects
young and old and
young
alike.
And old. Right.
Okay, thank you.
As my friend Liz Marquardt from Sojourner Family Peace Center said, abuse victims are some of the most vulnerable pro se litigants. Abusers commonly use children as leverage against their victims, and thus for victims, child custody cases can become the locus for the terrorizing dynamics that characterize domestic abuse generally. Abusive parents are, in fact, more likely to seek sole custody than nonviolent ones because child custody is a way to continue to assert power and control over the victim. Given the power imbalances that are inherent in abusive relationships, unrepresented victims are susceptible to ceding their rights to an abusive parent or abandoning the attempt to separate from the abuser altogether. Every year at the Coalition Against Domestic Violence, we publish the Wisconsin Domestic Violence Homicide Report. In the report's 11-year history, it has documented numerous instances in which circumstances related to child custody have resulted in a homicide. Last week, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel provided this account of an event for the release of the 2010 report. With her voice shaking, Patricia Burton described the pain and sorrow of losing her daughter, Sarah Rocio, 24, of Wauwatosa, on January 13, 2010, when she was killed by her former boyfriend, Benjamin Germano, in front of the couple's one-year-old daughter, Claire. She said her daughter had died just 15 days after the court refused to grant another restraining order, saying the two should get along and work things out for the sake of their daughter. Patricia is quoted as saying, "Victims of domestic violence should not be forced in contact with their perpetrators simply because they have a child in common. Unless this lesson is learned, children like Claire will continue to grow up without a mother." And while Sarah actually had an attorney for the restraining order in that case, the story highlights the struggle that many domestic violence victims endure in their quest for safety. This court can answer Patricia's call for action by ensuring that low-income litigants have access to representation in child custody cases and in other important civil legal matters. By and large, the laws of Wisconsin prioritize the safety of domestic violence victims, but they have very little practical effect when a victim is not represented by an attorney. For example, in a child custody case, a pro se victim neither knows how to present evidence that abuse occurred, nor how to meet the standards that trigger the presumption that the abuser should not be given sole or joint legal custody, or that the victim and the child should be the paramount concern when deciding physical placement. The need for this court to act is, in fact, urgent. Of the approximately 60 domestic violence victim service providers in Wisconsin, only 5 have attorneys on staff to represent victims, and some of those attorneys work part-time. As you heard from Liz Marquardt, most domestic violence programs have lay advocates, non-attorney advocates that can provide legal information, can help petitioners with restraining order forms, can accompany victims to court to make the process slightly less intimidating. But those advocates are going to be not able to provide the needs of survivors when the respondent in a restraining order petition or hearing is represented, or in even a moderately complex child custody case. And that doesn't even begin to address the fact that free civil legal services don't meet the current need, and that funding for those services has been reduced very recently. So in closing, I'd again like to urge you to support this petition. As the petitioners have stated, this court has the authority to take all the necessary steps to ensure the fair administration of justice in Wisconsin. What I want to stress is the concept of injustice does not begin to capture how navigating the legal system without a lawyer affects many low-income victims of domestic violence. For those individuals, the lack of legal representation can lead to lethal danger, terror, and violence. So thank you for considering my words. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Court's going to take a short break, but let me just make sure I have everybody who wants to speak on our list. My next person is Mary Baker, and I apologize to you, Ms. Baker, because I just skipped your name on this long list. And then we have President James Brennan and Outagamie County lobbyist Mark Whittingham. Is he here? Yes. And Margaret Bach of West Dallas. Is there anyone else who, Ms. Bach is not here. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak? And then we're going to have Mr. Abbott close it. Okay. All right. A really, for real, 5 minutes. For real.